Welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric V.
Today we are joined by Brandon. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you guys?
Doing pretty well,
good.
Man. Pretty
good.
Well. A little tired, but pretty good overall. Where are you from, Brandon?
I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Nice. All right. When were you first introduced to recovery?
I decided to get sober March 17th, 2012 was my date.
Nice. And have you been clean since that date?
Yes, yeah. I had had several sort of halfway attempts a lot of times before that, but that was the date that since that time I haven't had anything.
All right. Well, congratulations, man. Without further
ado. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you to share your story with us. So, pitter patter, let's get at her.
All right. Thank you, sir. Okay. So, my name is Brandon. Right now I live in Indianapolis, Indiana. I work as a career firefighter, paramedic. I actually run a wellness and support program for the Indianapolis Fire Department. We help firefighters and their families get addiction and behavioral health treatment and just help them out with life's general stressors, whatever they need help with. We try and find ways to make that happen. So that's where I am today. My story kind of starts back when I was 16. I, like a lot of kids of my era, a lot of Generation Xers, I grew up with Emergency as a show, Johnny and Roy on TV. And watching that, I decided that I wanted to become a firefighter. So when I turned 16... I joined the local volunteer fire company. I grew up in southwestern Indiana.
Nice.
Became a volunteer firefighter when I was 16. And you, at that time, I don't know what the current regulations are, but back then you could drive an ambulance when you were 16 as well.
Wow.
So I started driving ambulances. Yeah, yeah, pretty crazy. And I was exposed to a great deal of trauma and a lot of life's darkness at a very, very young age. And really wasn't... I was not prepared for that at 16.
Yeah. How many 16-year-olds are, though?
Yeah, exactly. And realistically, how many 18-year-olds, you know, for that matter?
Also true.
But so I had a lot of traumatic exposure during that time. And I had sampled alcohol even before then. But I started to regularly drink around that time. Because, I mean, you didn't talk about how the runs bothered you back then, especially there's such a stigma. There still is, but... so I sort of drank to cover the anxiety and to darken some of the images that I had seen. So fast forward a couple of years. When I turned 18, I became an EMT. And now I was working in the back of an ambulance. Rather than driving it, I was working in the back on patients. And one of my first calls as an EMT was on a gunshot wound. So yeah, and that business, that kind of pumps you up. Those are the calls you want. You know, you want the big trauma calls where you can go in and save a life. And unfortunately, it turned out that that was my great uncle who had been shot.
Oh my God!
And that's one of the risks of small town fire, EMS, and law enforcement is you run on a lot of people you know. So that led to he ultimately died about 2 weeks later. But I had I was overwhelmed by that. And had no ability whatsoever again to deal with it. So then I really started drinking and it kind of progressed. You know, I went on through college, went to business school. I ended up going to law school. I volunteered with fire departments all through that, worked for ambulance services all through law school. Was a prosecutor for a couple of years. Didn't like it. I knew I wanted to be a firefighter ultimately, so I quit practicing law and got on the fire department up here in Indianapolis.
Nice.
Continued, you know, still the stigma. I knew I had some issues, but there was no way I was going to come out of my shell to get any help because I was just too afraid of the stigma. And am I going to lose my job? And hey, if I can't cut it, how come I can't do it? But all these other tough guys can. You know, there's a lot of macho involved in this business. So I continued just to drink as my medication. Finally, in March of 2012, I got called for a random drug and alcohol screen. And I actually joked on the way out the door. I was like, I guess I won't be seeing you guys for a while, and kind of laughed about it because I didn't think anything was going to happen.
Yeah.
But I went down and I blew a .02 that morning just from alcohol left over in my system from the night before.
Huh.
And that's when everything really crashed down. You know, I was married at the time. My wife had been telling me, you need to slow down, you need to quit. But, you know, she was the one with the problem, not me, because, you know, I was doing fine. So, you know, then I had to go to headquarters and I got suspended and I was given the option that you can either take a month off without pay or you can take 24 hours without pay and enroll in our employee assistance program. So I took option two, cause I wanted to get better at that point. That was my defining moment, my stage of change, so to speak, where I went from contemplation to determination was right then.
Yeah.
So I went to our EAP and had a great social worker. He understood firefighters and how we think and some of the struggles that we have on the job and what we're exposed to. So I went through a program that I was able to get sober from the alcohol and never looked back from there. I recognized, you know, I wasn't the only person on the job with that issue.
Yeah.
And in fact, firefighters, the general population has an alcohol use disorder at a rate of about 6%.
Mm-hmm.
Firefighters have it about 30%.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a 500% difference.
I did not know that.
So we see a lot of substance abuse, and that goes for EMS and law enforcement as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, how can I get involved with this? It would help with my service work, and it would also help my brothers and sisters. So I got involved with our peer support program. And at that point, we were making a transition from critical incident stress management to a peer support model. So I got in right as things were starting to change. And that was, I guess, 6 years ago. And I remained very active with that on my days off of work, helping out firefighters. And fortunately, our current chief, Ernie Malone, is very pro-behavioral health. He recognizes what this job can do to people.
Yeah.
He recognizes that these are medical conditions. They're not character flaws. They're not moral failings. I mean, he gets it. He sees that these are legitimate medical issues that can be treated and people can recover from.
Yeah.
So he worked with us to see what we could do. So we got a chief of peer support. And then I came in shortly after that as the coordinator of peer support. And since that time, I've worked in our office full time for the last about year and a half. And we recently changed ourselves to the Office of Wellness and Support.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have two full-time administrative staff to assist firefighters. And we also have nine people out in the firehouses who work as peer support specialists that help as well. You know, I've been able to, that's one big thing that sobriety has given me the opportunity to do is to help other firefighters in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I got involved. The International Association of Firefighters is our international labor union.
Nice.
And they've been pushing behavioral health, and I was able to become an instructor for them. So now I'm able to go out on behalf of the union, and I've been all over the United States and Canada helping fire departments set up peer support programs from the ground up. In a two-day class, we go in and we will help a department build a behavioral health program. I travel tons of conferences where I speak on firefighter behavioral health. Most of those are fire conferences, but some are just professional conferences that give some time to talk about the issue to kind of spread awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a real honor and a real opportunity to get things out there.
Yeah.
Published a few articles even in some trade journals about firefighter behavioral health. I have one coming out again next month on stress and cancer. So, I mean, a really, really negative situation turned into a really, really positive outcome for not just me, but hopefully for a lot of other people in the fire service and for their families. You know, we're finally at a point where we're treating use disorders and behavioral health disorders like the medical conditions they are.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I think I got in on this. If there is a fortunate time to get in on it, I got in on it at a really good time.
Mm-hmm.
Has been able to make a difference for some people. So, you know, and as a part of that, there's just so much you can do with even things like safe talk and Smart Recovery. I'm a facilitator for that. You know, I just finished up today, actually, my community health worker and certified recovery specialist training through the Department of Mental Health and Addiction for the state of Indiana. So there's just so much out there that you can turn your recovery into so many positives.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, that kind of, I guess, takes us up to this point. If there's things that I can get into more, I'm happy to. Because, you know, to me, it's just kind of second nature since I lived it. But there, you know.
All right. Okay. That was short and sweet. We can work with that, I think.
That's awesome, right, man.
Yeah, I know it's a little short, but.
No, man, that's awesome. I definitely got quite a few questions. Do you want to go first, or should I?
You can go first.
I'm going to go first. Thank you, Eric. All right. So at the time, like, when you were dealing with, like, going out on those, like, traumatic runs at, like, a really young age, and like you said, you were exposed to a lot of trauma and stressful situations, did you know or like have an idea at the time that you were self-medicating? And like, did you ever like really realize that you were self-medicating?
I didn't for a long time, particularly starting out, you know, the fire service, law enforcement, EMS are alcohol cultures. There is nothing really you go to in the fire service that doesn't have a lot of alcohol available. And I mean, the numbers play that out, just such high numbers of alcohol use disorder. So to me, I was just doing what everybody else did. And I think we were all to a great extent, probably self-medicating at that time. And I, you know, I didn't recognize it. I was young. I knew it made me feel better, right? On some level it was working. That's the danger of it. Cause it does numb those feelings out. It does help you sleep.
Yeah.
So I don't think I really recognized the issue for a long time. Even, I mean, I would try after I became a career firefighter for Lent would come around and I would be like, well, I'll quit drinking for Lent. You know, that's how I'm going to prove to myself I don't have a problem. If I can quit for 40 days, I could quit for 400.
Yeah.
So I would try that and once in a while I would make it to 40 days. Normally I wouldn't, but I think that was part of my recognition that I had a problem, and that was just my way of kind of skirting it. But really, until I had that positive test, I thought I was doing okay. And I was really highly functioning. I never drank at work, ever. Even the day that I tested positive, I didn't feel intoxicated at all. I felt fine. My tolerance was so high. That 0.02 was nothing, you know? I mean,
yeah.
So I was just in such denial about it, which obviously is the safe haven of anybody with addictive behavior is the denial aspect. And that's, you know, that's what I did. So it wasn't until really probably 8 or 9 years ago that I really recognized that I had problems. And then I think, even though I didn't want to admit it, the problems were so deep seated that I just didn't see a way out, and the alcohol seemed to be working. So I just stuck with it.
All right. And I actually have a follow-up to that. So while you were in active alcoholism or addiction, you were using alcohol, you were using substances to really, like, help with your – as a coping mechanism for all those situations. What do you use now in recovery to help with those, like, stressful or traumatic situations and – what are the benefits?
I do a few things now. One is at least once a year, and I use my hire date to remind me. I call up our employee assistance program and I make an appointment and I talk to a professional once a year, whether I think I need it or not. Nice. Usually I go more than once a year. If I feel, and particularly it manifests in firefighters when we're starting to have problems, it manifests through anger normally. That's our big red flag. So if I notice that I'm getting short-tempered, I make an appointment with EAP. I don't hesitate to do that now. I meditate. Use an app on my phone. I like to meditate in the mornings. That really helps. Another thing, and I don't know if it falls under cognitive behavior therapy or what, but I try and keep in mind when something is frustrating or I've been on a bad call that, one, I tell myself this isn't the norm.
Yeah.
Right. These types of calls suck. They're terrible. But that's not the normal call we go on. So keeping that in perspective, and also keeping in perspective that the only things I can control are my thoughts and my actions.
Yep.
And that actually has helped me quite a bit. All the other stuff that I used to worry about and have anxiety about were things I couldn't control.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, fairly common among humans in general. But recognizing that there's only so much I can control, and, you know, those types of things really help me. I will still attend functions once in a while with other people in recovery. To be around, you know, have some fellowship and be around peers like that, I think that's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, probably what's helped more than anything, is being involved in peer support.
Yeah.
Being able to, you know, I mentioned I kind of got involved with it as part of my service work. But, you know, service work has the benefit of keeping us honest. It has the benefit of keeping you focused on what you need to be doing to do service. And that's really been huge, to be a role model, to be someone else that can help someone through their addiction or their behavioral health problem, has just been fundamental, probably more than anything else, to my own sobriety.
Yeah.
All right, Eric, what do you got?
All right, so I guess my first question was actually about stress, so we'll go to the second one.
Did I steal it?
Sort in a way, not really. It's too similar, though, to ask again.
Yes.
So
the benefit of going first, right?
Exactly.
Yeah right? So I guess, you know, looking at your life from when you were in active addiction to where you are now, and you're talking a lot about wellness programs. What does, you know, wellness look like for you today, and trying to achieve, you know, whatever that is on a daily basis? Like, what is that? How do you go about doing that?
I try daily to do a really honest assessment of how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain markers that I look for. In particular, one of our big concerns in this business is PTSD, and we know that the symptoms of that can appear years after that traumatic exposure.
Yeah.
So even though I'm at headquarters now, there's still a risk that something could happen, something could trigger one of those traumatic experiences. So daily I try and go through how have I been sleeping? Have I been having nightmares? Do I startle really easily? Some of those really basic traumatic stress questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect of it, is just doing that examination of myself. The other is physical activity. I run every day. I know that's not for everybody, but I do think that some type of physical activity, whether you're lifting weights or riding a bike or walking your dog or whatever, wrangling cats as it may be.
Yeah.
whatever you're doing, you know, to get some physical activity, I think it goes a long way. That's part of my wellness.
Mm-hmm.
I eat a lot better now. You know, I'm 5'11". When I was really in the throes of my addiction, I was 250 pounds, way overweight. And now, you know, I'm 198 now, so I'm happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken, you know, I try and pay attention to what I eat a lot better, and not having empty calories. I use intermittent fasting, day in, day out. That helps me. So, you know, I think wellness can't just focus on the addiction or the addictive behavior. You know, it's
absolutely,
because a lot of times that the underlying cause, you know, and I look at it, alcohol isn't addictive in itself. Drugs aren't addictive in themselves. Food isn't addictive in itself, but yet some people get addicted to food.
Yeah.
Some people get addicted to alcohol. So, you know, there's a whole body, a holistic approach that I think we have to take towards sobriety, that if you just focus on the substance and not what's driving you to want it, what's driving you to crave it, I think we're in a losing battle. And I think we have to be honest that real wellness goes well beyond what we're putting in our bodies that's causing the high or the drunk or the escape.
Absolutely.
You know, we're making the pain stop, but we need to figure out what's causing the pain. And our overall wellness has to take care of that pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
All right. You talked about how you were kind of worried about like the stigma of like being an alcoholic or being an addict, and mine, like, this is just more kind of like just like a general discussion between the three of us. Like, I've been thinking about the stigma of alcoholism and addiction a lot more recently, and it seems like culturally alcoholism is more accepted than like drug addiction or other substance abuses. And I don't understand the stigma of somebody having that issue. Like, why is there this cultural stigma with people who have the affliction of addiction, and more specifically people that are now in recovery? Why is there still a stigma for those people as well?
That's really, really interesting. I think part of it, particularly with alcohol, is even, you know, everybody has that drunk uncle, right? Or that person that they can think of, who embarrasses himself or herself, and by extension embarrasses the family, and we have to leave functions early because they're falling down, you know? So I think there's that, maybe that embarrassment tied to things like alcohol. And to the person who doesn't, I think maybe another issue for all substances is the person who doesn't have the addiction in their mind, why don't you just quit, right?
I mean,
nobody's forcing you to put that bottle to your lips. If you just don't do that, you're not going to be drunk anymore. And those of us who have that know that that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's that fundamental understanding of what it is, that it's still viewed as a moral failing or just a weakness. Like, how weak are you that you just don't get in your car and drive to the liquor store? It's simple, really. And I think when nice people look at it with those eyes, it seems like it is a failing of some kind.
Mm.
Plus, addicts are a real pain to live with. They're a pain to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, we lie, we cheat, we steal. Which, again, I think it brings in that moral failing aspect of it, or that seediness or fraudulent activity. So it's interesting to me, because I know in public safety, we'll go on a diabetic who's non-compliant with, say, their insulin. So they take too much insulin. They have a hypoglycemic episode. We come in, we start an IV, give them sugar, wake them up. And we may go on that person several times. As they learn to manage their diabetes. And it's no big deal, really. We do that all the time. But if we wake up somebody who's overdosed on heroin two or three times, the attitude is completely different, you know, as you might expect. Like, there's a real callousness in public safety towards, why do we have to keep waking these people up?
Oof.
And it's like, you know, because it's a disease just like diabetes. We don't ever say, why do we just keep going and waking up those diabetics?
You know?
But we just have a fundamental difference in the way we look at addiction, because I think I still see on Twitter and discussions of this sort of thing that, well, it's a choice, you know, becoming an addict is a choice. And I just think, how many of us, when we're younger, how many people try alcohol? You know, most people do. Underage, we try it. We give it a shot. And you never know when you're putting it up to your lips if you're going to be the one or not. So there really is a, there for the grace of God go I, is what our opinion should be of it, because so many of us try it and don't end up addicted. But I don't know. And for the recovery side of it, I think it's even tougher. I really don't understand where the stigma from that comes. I know it's there, but I definitely can't explain that.
No, that's
so weird.
That's never made sense to me. Like, the, especially, like, I'm confused about it because I'm in recovery and I don't understand why people on the outside, even with several years clean, kind of look at me kind of funny, being like, when I tell them that I'm an addict in recovery, like, it changes their perception of me in some way. And I don't know. What do you have any explanation for this, Eric? Anything?
I mean, it's just how people are conditioned. And if you condition people differently, over time, you know, stigma will change.
Is it just sort of like lumping like addiction in with like criminality? Is that like sort of
Well, that's
like
how people have been conditioned. An addict is a criminal.
Yeah.
Until you can condition people to, you know, think of it of like, okay, an addict has a mental illness, needs to be treated for that. Until people can like make that switch, they're still going to be like, well, if they're addicted to drugs, they're a criminal.
Yeah.
Because they're doing drugs and drugs are illegal. Mm-hmm. And that makes them a criminal. It's not that, you know, maybe they don't have self-control and, you know, because we don't have self-control, right? Once we put the drug in us, the control is gone.
Yeah.
So it's not, it, you know, it's, people don't think of it as like, there's an issue with the brain chemistry and, you know, this person is afflicted with an illness. They just think like, you know, you have weak willpower and you're not able to function like everyone else. So we should might as well just lock you away.
Yeah.
And like,
and I think too,
go ahead.
And we see depictions of, you know, in pop culture, wherever, you know, you picture, I mean, one, the labels we use for certain addictions are a big part of it. You know, the terms, we all know the terms, and I'm not even going to repeat them here, but there are very bad terminology associated with certain addictions. When we picture the person in the gutter, covered by newspapers, and you know, and then if you are somehow associated with that, even if you're in recovery, on some level, I think that's how people try and picture you. Is I wonder if this person was in the gutter with sores all over their face at some time, and you know, and then are you dirty? Do you have a disease? Can I? Do I even want to be around? You know, it's just we get so out of control with what we're led to believe addiction addicts are. You know, and it's the things we should celebrate. We just don't. I don't get it.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
What else you got, Eric?
So, you know, you're talking about like, you know, the peer support and the wellness program and all of that stuff. So I guess, you know, I like to think that we're doing something to make a difference with like this podcast or with like our social media efforts. But what to you is making a difference? Like, what does that mean to you and what you're doing in your community?
I think what's making a difference on our end is the more we talk about it, and part of what we do in peer support is just broad education. We do where we just visit the firehouse when there's nothing wrong. We don't have any, we haven't been requested, but we'll just come by to introduce ourselves, introduce the program, leave information about how to contact us. Maybe we'll have a campaign going on at that time about alcohol use disorder or depression, and we talk a little bit about those issues. And our goal with those is we just sit around the kitchen table at the fire station and talk about mental health, with an eye towards making it so that we can say the word depression in the firehouse and nobody thinks it's weird. So our goal is just to normalize that discussion. And that's been really helpful, just to sit and people that are respected. And that's a big part of the equation here is putting people on your team who are respected by other members of the department. I'm fortunate that, you know, I still had a good reputation. I was somebody who was reliable. I had been given several awards for rescues. I had been paramedic of the year, finished top in my class, finished top in my paramedic class. So people knew who I was, and they were surprised to find out that I had an issue. And I think on some level that made it more acceptable because I was one of the guys. So that's helpful, too, again, with that normalization that, all right, somebody just like me has this problem, so it's okay if I have it, too. And I can get help, and there's hope I can actually recover because Brandon did it. So those types of visits are helpful. Another really big thing we've done is in our recruit schools, we get in front of them, myself and our chief of peer support, and we talk about behavioral health. We talk about, hey, you're going to get, you know, a lot of speeches about how great this job is and all the good things about it, and it's all true. It's a great job. But there's also a very dark side to what we do. You know, you have to pick up body parts in the middle of the night. When somebody gets hit by a train, they call you. So we open their eyes up to that right out of the gate. This is going to change who you are. And that's okay. It's to be expected. And then we talk to them, you know, about coping and how to recognize that. And, you know, we know that alcohol is such a pernicious issue with us. We talk to them about self-medicating and resources. And I think that's had a huge difference, just making that part of their basic education. Mm-hmm. Generationally, too, I think we've seen a change. You know, I'm a Gen Xer, and I grew up with shows like Frasier, and Bob Newhart, you know, shows where characters worked in psychotherapy.
Yeah.
Friends and Seinfeld, they talked about, oh, I got to go talk to my therapist today about this. So I think we kind of started to see things shift with that. Starting with Generation X, we're just more open to the concept that people talk to therapists. It's not that big a deal. And I think now, particularly with millennials, there's even more openness to it. There's just much more cultural awareness and cultural acceptance that, you know, these things are what they are. They're medical conditions. And so I think we're just seeing a shift from maybe some older attitudes to some natural generational differences that are helping out as well.
You sort of touched on it a little bit right there, but I want to pull on that thread a little bit more. How have you seen like the change in the treatment model through time? Specifically in your experience, in your profession with both, behavioral health and addiction, like how has that, professionally kind of expanded to be more inclusive and actually more comprehensive, medically, to actually where it is today, and where can we see it going?
Well, when I first got involved in all this, you know, back in the early 90s, there was one, we didn't talk about behavioral health.
Yeah.
At all. And addiction was on the radar, but again, it wasn't really something we tried to fix or assist people with. And then I saw people would start to get help for their depression. And people would start to get help for alcohol, but they never got that help together. So a lot of people slip through the cracks because, okay, I'm getting treated for depression, but nobody ever talks to that person about their addiction to codeine or to alcohol. So,
yeah. Was that sort of before, you know, like the co-occurring sort of like became like a normal vocabulary?
Yeah, it was. And then that's kind of the next transition is now we recognize, hey, if we treat these things simultaneously, people have much better outcomes. And that's something that we've definitely seen within our system. We're fortunate that our clinical director is a retired firefighter and also happens to be a psychotherapist.
Nice.
He understands the culture. He understands dual diagnosis and how prevalent that is. And I think we see facilities shifting, and I'm very fortunate here in Indianapolis. You know, we're a city of 1 million people. We have a lot of behavioral health resources here.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of dual diagnosis facilities here as well. And more particular to the fire service, we're seeing programs popping up around the United States that cater to public safety. There's the Florian program and outside of Chicago. The Shatterproof program down in Florida. American Addiction Centers have a first responder program. The International Association of Firefighters has a dual diagnosis facility in Maryland that we can send our people to. It's gone from we don't even talk about either one at all to, hey, here's a facility specific for firefighters to deal with all of it at once with on-site detox.
Yeah.
And they coordinate IOP and aftercare. They'll call back, and for the next 18 months, they track you. I mean, it's just really, it's turned into so much better. I mean, where we talk about the dual diagnosis, and we're actually looking at least in Indianapolis, as part of our integrated healthcare, where when we go in for our annual physical, they ask us when we get with the nurse practitioner, hey, you know, they talk about depression, symptoms of PTSD, talk to us about alcohol use and sleep deprivation, drug use. So that's part of our physical exam. We have at our headquarters, we have a wellness center and a return to work center where people can do physical therapy and rehab. And the trainers and our peer fitness trainers who work with them are also educated in behavioral health and addiction. So that if they see that firefighter who's they suspect is, you know, maybe coming in and is talking about self-medicating, things like that, they can refer them to us and say, why don't you talk to peer support? Or they come in and they seem depressed and, you know, we can get them mad help. And it works both ways. If we're working with somebody who has been off work a long time, they maybe gotten hooked on pain pills, and they're overweight and they're down on themselves, we can get them into the trainers and work together. You know, that whole integrated care model is so fantastic. And you know, that's something that we're actively trying to do here. And it really is making a difference, and it builds so much trust in the program. And working on the medical side, I think just, it only adds legitimacy to the behavioral health and addiction side for people to see, oh, okay, well, the department is treating all these things equally, so it's okay if I need help because they're treated equally. So yeah, that's been the really big thing, is just seeing that integrated care model come into play, where medical, behavioral health, addiction, it's all symbiotic. You know, you can't have one without all the others.
Absolutely.
All right. You want me to go again, Eric?
Yeah, and then we'll do the Twitter question.
Okay. All right. I'm not sure if you mentioned this in your share or like when we were talking before. So you said you had experience with like the 12-step model of recovery, and now you more work with like smart recovery. What are talking to the people out there listening to this, anybody who's thinking about one or the other? Because me personally, I don't really know the differences between the two. So you're also talking to me here. Educate me on the differences of those two fellowships and, go with that.
They all work off of a peer model, which is great. But the 12-step approach has 12 very specific steps that you go through in order. And you don't move on from one until you complete the one before it. And there's a number of things on there, like if you need to apologize to people, if you need to make amends, admitting that you're powerless over alcohol, that type of thing. There's an attitude in the 12-step rooms that you're always in recovery, lifelong. You're powerless over the substance. You can't drink it normally, and for the rest of your life, you will be in recovery. And that works great for a lot of people. It certainly got me sober. And that's one of the things I like to point out is, in my view, you're in recovery when you say you're in recovery. That's not for me to judge at all.
Absolutely.
If you say you're in recovery, you're in recovery.
Yep.
And however you're doing that, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, do that. Do exactly what you need to do. I'm all in for that. So that's, you know, the 12 step, and that's something you would go to regularly. It's generally when you first get sober, 90 meetings in 90 days is very important for changing behaviors, changing habits. And some people choose to get a sponsor, so somebody that can help them work through the steps. Somebody at 3 a.m, I'm sitting outside the bar and I'm ready to go in, I can call my sponsor and my sponsor will help me deal with that crisis. And there are 12 steps. There are also 12 traditions that a lot of people don't know about. So it's a whole, these are the steps you work. These are the 12 traditions, the things we believe in, the things that make this what it is. There is some debate within those organizations on the, you know, those are abstinence programs. So depending on meetings, some folks are open to people who are receiving medication-assisted treatment. And others say, no, you're not abstaining if you're taking medication for it. That's a current debate. And that really varies. And that's kind of the 12-step side. It is very, very fellowship-driven, but there's also that element that you're always in recovery. Mm-hmm. Something like Smart Recovery takes a different approach. The people who develop Smart Recovery don't think that you're powerless.
Mm-hmm.
They think that, in fact, they believe the key to your recovery is in you. You're the only one who can recover.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can beat it. Maybe you can never drink normally again. But you can live a life where you don't crave it, where their view is you can stop going to meetings entirely and you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses, rational emotive behavioral therapy is actually the foundation for it. And that's things like cognitive behavior therapy. But it's actual very task driven where mm-hmm. at the meetings, one of the different, and they both have meetings, 12 mm-hmm. step, there'll be a topic and each person in the circle gets a chance to talk about that topic. There's yep. no crosstalk. You say your piece and you move on to the next person, but mm-hmm. you don't talk to each other.
Yep.
In a smart meeting, there will be a topic, but maybe somebody says, well, I'm trying to moderate my drinking. I'm not sure I want to quit, but I'm moderating and maybe that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
So then the facilitator will say, well, let's examine that. Let's do a cost benefit analysis and write it down or send them home and say, your homework is do a cost benefit analysis. And next week we'll look at that and see how much better things would be or how much worse things would be if you quit entirely.
Mm.
So it's very individual driven with what's going to work for you.
Mm.
And it's just a much, and in fact, in smart recovery, crosstalk is encouraged.
Yeah.
There's a view in smart recovery, that we're all experts. We're all qualified to talk about addiction,
mm-hmm.
Because we're all in it.
Yeah.
So if I have something to add, they encourage that as long as it's not demeaning or judgmental, you know, we want everybody to be objective,
mm-hmm.
but if you got something to add, add it.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference between the two. And then there are other, I'm not as familiar with things like SOS and Life Ring.
Yeah.
There are, and Celebrate Recovery. There are so many models out there, that I think most people could find something to fit them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, certainly the 12-step programs, they're great. Don't ever get me wrong on that. They are fantastic.
Yeah.
But they just operate much differently than things like Smart Recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that is the fundamental, can you ever recover? Is it okay if you're moderating, Smart Recovery is certainly promotes abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
They also are open to harm reduction, because keeping you alive another day, however you do that, is better than trying to abstain and completely falling off the wagon and overdosing or whatever it may be.
Mm.
So harm reduction is accepted. That, hey, abstinence is what they prefer.
Yeah.
But they'll take harm reduction. And that's my view too. You know, I'm all for harm reduction.
And, yeah.
And I wish we could get more of society on board with that. The value of things like needle exchanges and, let's not make this public health crisis worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's awesome.
All right. So I guess we'll go to our Twitter question. I was actually going to bring up your topic that you presented as the Twitter thing, but since you have worked the steps, we will do a question from at Candace Lee Wright. And the question is, so a new sponsee wants to go through the 11th step nightly review when she hasn't worked step one yet. So I urged her to be cautious because she isn't at that step yet. What do you think? So what do you guys think about doing an 11th step nightly without having gone through? And we just talked about the steps a little bit there,
yeah,
and how they are meant to be done in an order. So what do you think about, doing the 11th step without doing the review for the 11th step, like the meditation, the prayer, the conscious contact, without going through this first 11, first 10.
Okay. You want to go first, Brandon?
I can. You know, okay. For me, And maybe it might just be the way that my brain works, that it was laid out for me in order, mm-hmm. and that's how I did it. Yep. And that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I guess, what I would stick with is people who follow those steps in order have success.
Yep.
And me working those steps in order had success.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my advice. Now, is it maybe hypocritical for me to say that when I just got done saying that whatever works for you is what you should do? Probably is.
So, yeah.
You know, if you're asking me, I guess I would put it like this. If doing that 11th step out of order is working for you, fine. But absolutely. If you haven't attempted it yet, I would say stick with following them in order. If that's the issue, that I'm not sure if I want to do them out of order, I would recommend, do it in order. Mm-hmm. Because they're laid out that way, and they've been tested for generations now in that order for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It seems a little hypocritical to say that, but if you've been doing that 11th step and it's working, great, stick with it. But mm-hmm. if you're on the fence, should I or shouldn't I, then I would say I would just work it in order.
Yeah. I agree with you. Like, I see both sides of this coin. 100%. Like, I've done the steps in order for a reason, because that's the way they were laid out. That's the way my sponsor did it. And like, that's just tradition. But like, I'm also for, just to some extent, bucking tradition or doing what works necessarily.
Right.
So I really think it's, and I like what you said in the smart recovery, how it's very individual based. Like, I don't want to be hypocritical either and say, like, you have to do it this way, because my way is not everybody's way of recovery. So, again, like, I'm going to reiterate what you said. Like, if it's working, by all means, do it. But I think the sponsor should definitely, sit down with their sponsee and sort of talk about it and maybe try and explain why they're in the order they're in for that purpose. But the 11th step, like, it's all about like your conscious contact with your own higher power and using prayer and meditation. So by all means, in recovery, it's never too early to practice any of that. Like, from day one, if you want to meditate, you want to pray, you want to start developing your own spirituality, by all means, do that. But as far as like, quote unquote, officially working it by whatever program standard or sponsorship standard, talk to your sponsor. Just like, it's about open communication and find out what works best for both of you in a working relationship, because this isn't pass fail. Like, the steps are not, you're not being graded. Your sponsor does not have all the answers when it comes to the steps. Like, every day we're clean together is the most clean time that we've all had. So it's all just a constant, it's a constant evolving guessing game. That's never going to be perfect. So you work on it, you communicate, and like, there's no right or wrong answer, really. Like, if she wants to do the 11th step, or like, cherry pick a little bit of it and then get to the bulk of it later, just do what works. And as long as they're staying clean, that's what's important.
Yeah. And I think part of it, that 11th step is so specific to your higher power, in my view, particularly as it pertains to your recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's towards the end, because you can pray, like you said, you can pray and meditate and have that relationship with nature and your spirituality and, mm-hmm. and God, whatever it is in general. But I think it's so particular in the 11th step to your higher power as you know it to be in your recovery.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's a little more specific, I think, but it's so nuanced that, I don't know, it's tough, but I think you hit it right on the head with everything you said, that, if it's working, do it, but,
mm-hmm.
That was good.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're good at this stuff.
Yeah. It's like I've been in front of a mic before or something. All right. Do we have time for one more, Eric?
Sure.
Okay. I got one more. And this is for both Eric and Brandon. I'm going to ask both of you. And especially because, Brandon, you're our man on the inside. I need a professional opinion on this. How can we, culturally right now, how can we counter the opioid epidemic? Like, you're seeing it all the time, like the firefighters, the EMTs, the police force is seeing the front lines of the opioid epidemic. How can we combat that as a culture and, like, on your standpoint of first response?
Oh, boy. You know, it was mentioned earlier with, you know, and I know criminalization is such a touchy topic, but that is a big part of this, that recognizing the disease side of this and educating the population that people who are addicted to narcotics really don't like it. You know, there's an aspect that's working for them, whether it's just to keep them from withdrawing, they're getting some benefit. Otherwise they still wouldn't be doing it. But recognizing that it's an illness and there's probably something driving it. But I mean, I really think that's the biggest thing is we have to somehow make the shift from this is criminal conduct and it's degenerate and it's dirty and filthy, you know, and all the negatives associated with it. This is an illness. And to instill hope, you know, most people do recover. And I don't think the general population knows that. I think most people who, have, you know, opioid use disorder or narcotics issues, that they eventually all overdose and die, and very few survive. But it's just the opposite. And I think getting that word out that, look, people recover from this, and the sooner we help them do that, the sooner they become productive and have jobs, and EMS and fire and police aren't making 10 runs on them a week. Instead, they're paying into the system and being productive. And people do recover all the time. We just don't know about it because we're too damned ashamed to say it. People recover all the time, you know. But I don't know how to really do that, other than, you know, I think schools are a good place to start in educating about what use disorders are. Because I think you kind of have to draw that line in the sand with our youth and say, this is where we're going to make the change. Short of that, you know, I'm just not real sure. It's so ingrained to be a criminal act that I just think it's going to take maybe the next generation to figure out that now. And I think we do see that. You know, I've mentioned millennials. I think there has been a big culture shift with millennials, and I think Generation Z or whatever comes after millennials are going to be even more so. So I see the seeds there, but it's, you know, the person who plants the tree doesn't get to enjoy its shade, sort of thing. I don't know how that thing goes, but, you know, it takes it a while to grow, but I think the seeds are there. I honestly do.
All right. You got anything to add to that, Eric?
So, I mean, I have some controversial, like, ideas with how to fix this problem. Some are controversial, some aren't. I actually think that, and this idea gets floated around every once in a while, and they do it, I believe, in some places in Europe. I think it might be happening in Seattle right now.
Just broad sweeping legalization?
Much legalization, but a safe place to use it. So, especially
Vancouver does that.
Especially with like heroin and more so fentanyl. So if you think about it from just a, you know, like
a clinical aspect.
Yeah, I mean, look at the street. Like we're in Baltimore. So, I mean, Baltimore, you know, it's not weird for people that we know to die. Like that's a pretty common occurrence, and it's like as weird as it sounds to some people, like it doesn't, like, I'm almost numb to people being like, oh, yeah, that person OD'd. And it's like, okay. Well, that's what happens. But if people had a safe place to use, and it's mainly the fentanyl at this point, because I don't remember. I mean, people died when we were younger, but it wasn't like this.
Yeah.
And like, if people were able to get the dope that they needed, you know, it's like a methadone clinic. People go to methadone clinics every single day.
Yeah.
If people could get clean needles and they could get like, you know, they could get dope that doesn't have fentanyl laced in it or like, you know, heaven forbid, like carfentanil.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, because mm-hmm. I believe carfentanil has been found as close as Pennsylvania to our state.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's so dangerous that I'd rather people be able to use something that they actually know what it is than taking the risk of, like, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
the tester could kill you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just, like, testing the dope can kill you. Like, mm-hmm. that's insane. Like, let's, you know, and, like, another aspect to this, and, like, you know, I maintain my anonymity. You know, like, you're a little more forward than I am.
Yes.
Like, but, you know, I work at, like, a Fortune 500 company, and, like, I just have, like, certain, like, things I have to keep up. And, but if people saw, like, you know, if there's more marketing and more of a campaign around the idea that, like, someone like me was a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if someone, if they could see that, like, this person who does this, like, all these things that I do or have done, and it's like, you know what? This person also shot heroin.
And I, honestly, along that line, like, I'm going to stretch that a little bit further. I think it would behoove kind of the celebrity population. Like, some of us know, like, the celebrities that are in recovery or have a certain amount of clean time. They're like it or not, Hollywood is very much the face of American culture. And if some of these people with 10, 15, 20 years clean could come forward and, like, be like, hey, look what I've been doing. I've been clean since so-and-so. Like, I know Anthony Hopkins has been clean for, what, almost 30 years?
Yeah, but those people are almost, like, you know, they're, like, mythical creatures, right? So they're, like, they're beyond what we are normally, you know, associating with. If we could have teachers, doctors, like, executives at a company, like, you know what I mean? Like, firefighters, right? Like, if you have normal people who are, like, I am this, but I was also this.
Yeah.
And now I'm in recovery.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, you got to, like, spin the campaign to be, you know, yeah, it's great that, like, what, who's the one that you always talk about that you, celebrity?
Russell Brand.
Russell Brand. You're always like, Russell Brand. And it's like, yeah, Russell Brand's great, man.
Very open.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, his like, yeah, it's great. But who's that person that I can relate to? That, you know, because, like, those, you know, regular people are going to look at that and just be like, well, it's Russell Brand.
Yeah.
But if they look at, like, a teacher and they're like, that's a sixth grade teacher. Like,
you
know, they had a problem with alcohol. Maybe I have a problem with alcohol.
Mm.
That's interesting. I think, you know, on some level, I think that would hit closer because they can, there is that, I can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that Boston has done with their fire department is they go on a heroin overdose, the next day they have people at that person's house, if they have roommates or people that live with them, and they provide Narcan and they provide training. So now that's, you know, again, harm reduction. That one, it cuts down on EMS and fire demand, but it also, the 5 minutes while, or however long you're waiting for first responders to get there while that person's not breathing, is killing them. So that's something that they're trying, and I think they've had pretty good success with it.
Exactly.
You also mentioned the safe injection sites. Part of most of those, if not all of them, is they have treatment facilities attached to them or affiliated with them.
Exactly.
And the goal is to get that trust, get the trust of the users and the people who may someday want to be recovered. And hey, great, we can get you in. I mean, but you don't, somebody just doesn't come off the street normally and say, hey, I trust you with all this. Get me some help.
Yeah, exactly, right.
And those facilities are a way to build that rapport so you can get the trust. And then when people are ready, you keep them alive because if they're dead, they can't go into treatment, obviously.
Yeah.
So you keep them alive through safe injection. And when they're ready, you can get them in. You know, it's just a different way of looking at the issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree.
All right. I think we're about
out of time. Yeah.
So we're going to take our quick 10 seconds to give you a golf clap, Brandon, for coming and joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we'd like to give you a quick minute to talk to anybody who's listening out there who's struggling or just needs to hear that message or that word of hope. What do you have to say to them?
You know, you're not alone. A lot of people have struggled. You can recover, and you deserve it. That's probably the biggest thing. Mm. You deserve to feel better. You deserve to have your life back.
Yep. All right. Perfect. Love it. Short and sweet. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. All right, again, thank you, Brandon. Keep listening in. Absolutely. Follow us on Twitter, everyone. Follow us on Facebook. Like, share, subscribe. Leave us your questions.
Follow us on Instagram too.
Follow us
I
on
just
Instagram.
Did that. So yeah, follow us on Instagram.
We're on Instagram now.
And subscribe to us on YouTube.
And we're on YouTube.
Yeah.
Wow, this
I was
is big,
busy this week.
This is a big day. This is a big week. Good for you, Eric. All right. Well, most importantly, everybody out there, thank you for listening. But stay safe and stay clean.